This episode of the Robot Report podcast is brought to you by Futek Advanced Sensor Technology. Futek helps leading innovators shape the future by providing custom sensing and test measurement instruments for groundbreaking applications. Futek solutions push the limits of measurement capabilities and development to reinvent and redefine sensor technology. To learn more, visit Futek.com. What's up, everyone? Welcome to episode 36 of the Robot Report podcast, which brings conversations with robotics innovators straight to you. I'm Steve Crow, editor of the Robot Report. Thanks, as always, folks, for tuning in. You can find us on Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, anywhere you get your podcasts. Please subscribe, leave us a rating, give us a review. Another great show for you today. We'll get an investor's perspective on the current state of robotics with Kevin Dunlap of Calibrate Ventures. We'll also get into the top stories of the week and recap the week that was in robotics. But first up here, I need to get something off my chest. I want to apologize to the fine folks over at Boston Dynamics. I haven't talked about them for a couple of weeks, so I want to bring them back up here. The crap that they've dealt with this week, whether it be the quote-unquote art demonstration that attached a paintball gun to Spot's back and let people control it over the internet, or AOC, the Democratic representative from New York, dragging Spot through the mud. There's articles being written now about how to quickly disengage Spot by removing its battery. I mean, come on, people. What are we doing here? I want to read one of the tweets that Ocasio-Cortez sent out this week. Quote, "Shout out to everyone who fought against community advocates who demanded these resources go to investments like school counseling instead. Now robotic surveillance ground drones are being deployed for testing on low-income communities of color with under-resourced schools." That's the end of the quote. Now, it's really the last part of that tweet that bugs me. Boston Dynamics' robot, Spot, it's being tested in a bunch of different places, not just on low-income communities of color with under-resourced schools. And, you know, my wife's a teacher, so under-resourced schools, I'm pretty familiar with that. It's a major problem in many parts of the world. But it literally, this has nothing to do with a four-legged robot that's designed to walk around industrial environments and capture data from different types of sensors and gauges. She was taking aim at the New York Police Department, and that same police department back in October of 2020 also deployed Spot while it was investigating a shooting in Brooklyn. After accidentally shooting someone in the head during a parking dispute, that gunman was holed up in an apartment building. And instead of sending a human in first, going in blind, not knowing where that person is, are they still armed, are they still dangerous, instead of sending a human into potentially harm's way, the New York Police Department sent Spot in first. I don't see how that's a bad thing. Almost 2 years ago, the bomb squad unit of the Massachusetts State Police Department was also testing Spot. They were looking to see how, again, robots could be used to remove humans from potential harm. And, you know, Boston Dynamics, they can't be any more upfront on where they stand on this, where they stand on weaponized robots. They've made it very, very clear. There's language in their purchase and sales agreement that, you know, they don't want anybody using Spot in any sort of application that could be potentially harmful. And I know nobody listening to this is trashing Boston Dynamics, but as I've said to Boston Dynamics before, it's just got to be so damn frustrating to deal with this crap all the time. I mean, can we direct our anger or the fear or the uncomfortableness towards the people who are using the robots incorrectly or misrepresenting what these robots were designed for, and not the people who are building the robots? Again, the New York Police Department did nothing wrong here. The Massachusetts State Police Department did nothing wrong. All the industrial users who are using Spot to, again, monitor their facilities are doing nothing wrong. This art group is doing something wrong. And it's frankly, it's out of Boston Dynamics' control. I know they do a lot to try to vet the customers to which they sell Spot and to which they'll sell their future robots that are commercialized. But frankly, I don't really understand why they have to answer for this stuff. You know, certainly they're probably doing it for PR reasons and to try to be on the right side of things here, but it's pointless. It's not going to work, right? People feel about how these things, how they feel about it. And I don't think anything they say or do is going to change your mind, their mind, because when you really boil it down, how is their robot any different from any other product that anybody can buy on the open market? When I buy a car, are they asking me how I'm going to use that car? If I take that car and intentionally use it to harm someone, is that car company responsible for that action, or am I responsible for that action? If I buy any sort of tool, a hammer, a drill, a pocket knife, anything, and I use it to harm someone and not use it for what it's actually intended for, that's my problem. That's my fault, not the person or the company that built that tool. And again, I just don't understand how Spot is any different in this instance. Literally, Spot can't do anything unless a human being turns it on and programs it to do something. Now, you get into the future when these things are sentient, and I just don't buy into that belief. You know, certainly pop culture has influenced many of people to believe that that will someday happen. I don't buy that. I know a lot of robotics folks don't buy that either, but just a crazy, crazy week for them. Hopefully they're dealing well with it. It's almost the end of the day here on Friday, so hopefully they can get some adult beverages going over there. But IEEE Spectrum has a pretty good piece on this week. Evan Ackerman does a great job. He had some commentary from Boston Dynamics, Anybotics, another quadruped developer, and ClearPath Robotics, just about the ethical dilemmas surrounding roboticists and robotics companies. But I just don't see why or how roboticists or robotics companies should be held responsible for how their robots are used. They should not. They can do all they want to try to vet their customers and vet how these customers are going to use the robot, but that artist group somehow got their hands on a Spot robot. Somehow, someone put up $75,000 for Spot to be used in an artist's, you know, demonstration. No one is ever going to be able to fully vet every single customer that you sell a product to. So again, I just don't see how this is any different from any other product that's on the open market available for purchase. And, you know, at the end of the day, the users should be held responsible for the actions of that product, not the developers. Anywho, moving on here, the investment landscape currently going crazy in the robotics industry. We actually ran a webinar earlier this week, recapping the 2020 investment landscape. And we tracked more than $15.7 billion, that's with a B, dollars invested into robotics companies. And to help try to make sense of all this, we're joined now by Kevin Dunlap. He's the co-founder and managing partner of Calibrate Ventures, a California-based venture capital firm investing in early stage, early revenue automation and artificial intelligence companies. Some of its portfolio companies you guys are well familiar with. They include Built Robotics, Embodied FarmWise, Misty Robotics, Soft Robotics, and 3D Robotics. Kevin, thanks for being here, sir. Must be an interesting time to be an investor in the robotics space, huh?
Yeah, it's a very interesting time. You know, this is something we've been doing for a long time. I think we made our first robotics investment as a team back in 2011 at a prior firm, and it was something that we were really excited about and believed would ultimately have legs, and I think we're seeing it come to fruition now, for sure.
I think you're right. So just, yeah, give us the backstory about Calibrate Ventures and how it came to be and why you guys decided to, you know, not exclusively focus on robotics, but most of what you do is on the robotic side of things. So tell us how this all came together.
Yeah, so Calibrate Ventures is an early stage venture capital firm that invests in innovative companies that are leveraging AI, automation, robotics, and digitalization to transform multiple industries. My partner and I had been working together for 14 years at a prior firm, had a number of successful exits in fast growing companies like Ring, Dollar Shave Club, Baijiu's, Chegg, handful of others. And so in 2017, we spun out and formed Calibrate. We really realized that our portfolio companies and their end customers could really benefit from automation and digitalization. And we're seeing that even with other companies that you wouldn't necessarily think of, like D2C, as well as others that needed warehouse automation, digitalization within their enterprise. And that was really the thesis around Calibre in 2017. We believe that this phase is really going to unlock significant value for our LPs and for opportunity within larger corporations over the years, pretty similar to kind of the transition we saw from on-prem software to SaaS a number of years ago. We feel it's pretty similar where we are in a time frame, just with the ability to achieve outcomes with robotics. I mean, I think we've seen and benefited from, reduced battery sizes, improved storage around energy, microization of sensors, and all these things lead to the ability to achieve outcomes that weren't possible 10 years ago.
That must have been a good one for your ring, huh?
That
Acquired
was a
by.
good one,
Some are better than the others, but that must have been a really good one. I have a ring doorbell myself. The thing's phenomenal. Great, great invention there. But we cover investments a lot on the Robot Report. It's sort of embedded in the genesis of how that website came to be. We don't really have to get into that, but curious how I see a lot of head scratcher investments from my standpoint. Again, I'm not an investment expert, but see a lot of these investments, which we'll get into later on, that make me scratch my head and just make me wonder what the heck's going on. But what can you tell us about how Calibrate Ventures evaluates companies and ultimately decides, hey, that's a company I would really like to invest in, or hey, maybe you guys aren't ready right now, come back to us at some point down the line. How do you ultimately decide on what companies you do invest in?
Yeah, so for us, it really comes down to the stage. So we say we're Series A investors. Sometimes that could be a seed extension. Sometimes that could be an early B. We're not as necessarily focused on the nomenclature of the round. Really focused on where the company is in its own stage. So for us, as companies, have got to build a product that's built. It's got early traction with a couple of customers that we think it can actually scale with. Not necessarily proof of concept, but actual contracts. And so that's typically, half a million to a couple million in revenue, the stage where we come in and we lead about two-thirds of the deals that we invest in. Typical check size is 2 to 5 million initially. But what we really start with, and what Jason and I learned from our mentor or prior firm, is that everything really focuses around people. So for us, that's the most important aspect. As much as we'd always like to think that it's the market, it's the tech, and that's what we're really focused on, venture investors are all about finding great teams and supporting them and backing them. So that's the first cut. The second cut is, we really focus on the market opportunity. We spend a lot of time looking at trends, seeing what other companies and strategics are doing, understanding what the end customers at our portfolio companies are focused on. We've been fortunate that we've had Honeywell, Amazon, ABB, FANUC, Unilever, a number of other strategics as both investors and acquirers of our companies. And so we start there looking at the trends, looking at the problems that need to be solved within those organizations, and really understand the market. And when I say market, it doesn't have to be something that's a massive market now. It can be something that's nascent, but something we believe can also really grow. I mean, you talked a little bit about Ring at the beginning there. I led the Series B at Ring. I think when we first made that investment, nobody thought about doorbells, right? I mean, what was the addressable market for doorbells? It was probably dozens of dollars. But what Jamie really did was he built something truly special that couldn't have been built 10 years earlier ago because of the sensors, the cameras, the battery life, everything that comes with that. And so he started with this idea of security at the front door, then the ring of security around the home, and then the ring of security around the neighborhood, really taking a doorbell, connecting it with an app, and then bringing communities safer and closer together. So I think that's a great example of markets don't necessarily have to be something that we can totally say is a $10 billion TAM today, but it could be something that we think can grow into that relatively quickly over time. So those are the first two cuts, people, markets, and then we really dig into the unit economics of the business. And so everything that we really focus on has some sort of recurring revenue associated with it. So if it's a SaaS company, it already has that. But if it's SaaS-enabled hardware or robotics, it's got to have that recurring revenue component because that's what the acquirers actually value when they come in and buy a business or if you go public, right? The markets want to see that repeatability in the business. And so they'll pay significantly higher multiples if you have that repeatability. Sometimes it can be hardware that you're selling at close or has lower margins, but if you have a recurring revenue subscription that's adding real gross margin to the LTV of the customer, that's important. And other times it could be a pure RaaS model or robots as a service model like FarmWise, where we're actually going out and just operating, getting paid on a per acre basis. So at a high level, those are the three main cuts. Those are how we look at businesses. They've got to fit within that criteria. And I think you're right. You know, I think the nature of seed investing is investing in vision. So you and I might scratch our head, especially at some of the early stage investments, and wonder what's going on there. But oftentimes people have a vision, and oftentimes they can actually see those to fruition.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with you on your first point there about people and just making sure that the team, you know, from the investment side, but also on the product side, sort of gels together. We see time and time again where that doesn't work out in the robotics industry. But one that I want to bring up is Calibrate Ventures invests in Embodied. And you have a history with Paolo Perginian. He's the founder of Embodied. I believe you were investors in his earlier company, Evolution Robotics, which was acquired by iRobot a long time ago. Paolo's a great guy, advocate for this industry. I believe he was the second person we actually had on the podcast, second or third person we had on this podcast. He also spoke in our Robo Business Direct series about the challenges and opportunity that lie ahead for social robots and a fascinating product that they have. But as you well know, I think you and I have probably talked about this before, you know, social robots have certainly struggled over the years. Jibo is the prime example that comes to mind. They're sort of in the process of coming back to life via NTT disruption. But what was attractive about Embodied? Again, I know that relationship is there with Paolo, but take us through that process and why you guys decided to invest in his new venture, Embodied, which is developing the Moxie social robot, which is really geared towards aiding child development.
Yeah, I think there are a couple of things. I think oftentimes, especially within investing, sometimes things can be ahead of their time or we're not quite ready for them yet. I think there can also be some issues around what is the actual purpose of something versus whether it's cool or not. I mean, I think even if you look at a lot of the smart speakers with Alexa and others, a lot of their purpose has been really simply playing music.
That's what, we have a bunch of Alexas throughout the house, and that's all we use it for. That's all we use it for, is to control the Sonos. And I got three little kids under seven, and I don't know if this is a sad state of reality or not, but I have a one-year-old, and we have videos of her standing next to an Echo saying Echo, Echo. It's like her one of her first words is Echo, you know, which is a testament to, I guess, the usability, or I don't know, but you're right. That's all that we really use it for at this point, is to control music.
Yeah, my four-year-old will oftentimes, when it doesn't play the song she wants or something, you can often hear her scream, "No Alexa."
It's frustrated. Yeah.
But coming back to Paolo and Embodied, you know, I think as we were investors in Evolution, which was acquired by iRobot shortly after we invested, and then Paolo went on to become the CTO of iRobot. And after a number of years, developed the concept around Embodied, which we got really excited about. I think, you know, if you look at robotics, I think we generally think of the first wave being around simple navigation, you know, looking at logistics, some home robots around Roomba and some different things. You move to the second wave, robots are getting smarter. They're implementing soft articulation, soft robotics. They're looking at vision-based manipulation, thinking about more advancements within factories and self-driving and others. And then we think the third opportunity, which we think is actually much larger, is really a wave of fueled human-machine interaction. And so what Paolo's doing, and we think the timing's now, because we've got deep neural networks, we got NLP, we've got a lot of other technologies that are actually getting to be able to be implemented with compute power and other things that we have access to now, that we can have true interaction between robots that can be much deeper than just saying, "Hey Alexa, play me my favorite Frozen song." And so our belief in our investment thesis is one, we really believe in Paolo and his ability to build and execute on a vision. And then we also believe there's a massive market that's available where people will become more integrated and actually look for more support from robotics and assistance beyond just the simplicity that we're seeing currently.
Hey, don't sleep on that Frozen soundtrack. That's that thing jams, man. We got that playing here all the time.
For sure.
But I think you sort of opened my eyes to that. I think one of the first times you and I talked, we talked about embodied, and I think I brought it up from a hardware perspective. And certainly that plays into what they're doing with Moxie. But to your point, very well taken point, is really the key to that product is on the software side.
Yeah, and I think, if there's an interesting trend where investors are referring to robotics and other things as hardware-enabled SaaS. I'm not sure I totally love that nomenclature reference, but I think in a lot of ways it's relatively true and speaks to the power that is being unlocked. It's not necessarily the hardware in a lot of these applications. It really comes down to the software. I mean, if you look at our company Built Robotics, they don't actually make any of the machinery. They
Sure.
retrofit everything and use their own software and sensors to achieve the outcome they're looking for. As much as investors and others think that, oh, it's robotics and it's this and it's the hardware, it really comes down to the engines that are driving the hardware and the data that's collected and the way that you use that data.
So I was doing a little research on you, putting my investigator's hat on for a minute, and nothing bad. So you have a degree in mechanical engineering, and this is crazy. You did a stint as an engineer, right, at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, JPL,
Yeah.
earlier in your career. Unbelievable. I just watched, and I talked about this on, I think it was the last podcast that we did. Just after the rover touched down on Mars, there was a great documentary on National Geographic that took us inside the NASA JPL operation and just sort of broke down their thought process when they were getting down to the, crunch time with developing the rover, and they weren't sure if they were going to make it in time. They were having some challenges with, some of the components inside the rover. But just tell us about your time there. I mean, did you actually work on any space related projects during your time there? And just what are your thoughts now on what you're seeing with the Mars 2020 mission?
Yeah, so I actually worked in a group called Team X, which was working with principals and scientists that were coming and proposing concepts and ideas around new missions. So I wasn't directly involved in the rovers, but I was there at JPL when Spirit and Opportunity launched and landed on Mars.
Wow.
So obviously a very exciting time.
Yeah.
Even though I wasn't on that team, you could feel the excitement on the campus and it was totally infectious, right? And I think, I watched the 2020 mission here, and I watched the landing live. And I think the thing that stood out for me most was just how smooth the landing was. When Spirit and Opportunity landed on Mars, they used a chute, but what they had was they had an encapsulated device that actually inflated airbags. And it was dropped and bounced several times, and it had a mechanism that made sure it always opened so the orientation was correct so the rover could roll off the platform. But you didn't know exactly where it was going to land, and there were lots of bounces along the way. And I
Yeah.
remember just the angst and energy in the room when it finally settled down and opened and uncrated itself to be able to roll off, and it was really exciting. But as I was watching Perseverance, I was just amazed at how smooth and targeted the landing was. And, not being as close to it, I started digging in and taking a look. And I realized that, we'd use we meaning us as a nation, used sky cranes before, right? And so the concept of the chute, the sky crane, and dropping it down was something that had been done in prior missions. But this was the first mission where they actually used terrain relative navigation.
That's the most
And
impressive thing to me. Unbelievable.
it's totally amazing, right? I mean, they pinpointed where they wanted to land so they could get the most out of the mission. They did it entirely autonomously with pre-programmed maps and visualization, and they achieved their outcome, right? I mean, it's pretty amazing.
How many millions of miles is it? Is it th like 300 million miles?
Something like that. Yeah, and they come in at like 12 or 13,000 miles per hour, right? I mean, It's amazing. It's also really interesting to see simple things like Spirit and Opportunity. They only planned the mission to last something like 92 days or something like that. And both those rovers lasted, well, one of them was like 20 times, the other one was like 50 times longer than life expectancy. So I'm really excited to see what they can do with Perseverance and what they're able to find, because I'm constantly in awe of what that organization produces from an innovation and accomplishment.
Yeah, the terrain navigation software was certainly the most impressive thing to me. Just the sheer distance of this thing is, you know, I had an issue not too long ago with recording a Zoom conversation, right? It seems something so simple, right? Yet we can't figure out these video conferencing or audio conferencing systems. There's always a problem. Yet the unbelievable folks at NASA JPL send this thing 300 million miles away and get it to autonomously land on a very targeted spot on Mars. And a lot of them are working from home. You know, you've seen some of these videos that have come out after the fact. These guys and girls they're working from home, checking in on, you know, how the mission is going those final 7 minutes, checking on things from the comfort of their own home due to the coronavirus and how that's impacted their ability to go to work and be in the office. So just incredible, incredible stuff.
It was pretty cool. It was a pretty cool code they hid in the chute too, right? Derping things and putting JPL's coordinates on there.
Yeah.
Pretty innovative.
So we have complete coverage of that for the folks listening, Mars 2020 mission on therobotreport.com. So make sure you check it out. But, you know, one thing I want to get into, and I know Calibrate's an early stage venture firm, but I need some more help. I have an industry friend who's on the investment side of things, and he's explained these SPACs, special purpose acquisition companies, to me in the past. He actually did it on the podcast. What the heck's going on here? I mean, this is just, to me, getting nuts. There was over 200 SPACs, I believe, in 2020. Now creeping into the robotics industry, Berkshire Grey just announced a couple of days ago it's going public via a $2.7 billion SPAC. We've seen six LiDAR companies that have already gone public or are going to go public via SPAC. What can you tell me about this trend? And to me, it seems like the benefit to the robotics company, obviously the founders are, I believe, making a pretty penny here, but it also gives them access to a tremendous amount of cash to continue to scale. But just what can you tell me about what's going on here with the SPAC trend?
Yeah. So if you go into the mechanics of the SPACs on another episode, we obviously don't need to do that now, but I think what's interesting is, you know, having been investing for 20 years, we saw the kind of rise of SPACs in 2006, 2007. They died off in 2008. Nothing like the velocity we've seen recently. It's orders of magnitude larger today than it was in 06, 07. But what I think you're seeing is, I think you're seeing a couple of things. You're seeing companies stay private longer, which has gotten public market investors excited about accessing companies earlier. And a SPAC allows you to effectively do that, right? If a company was doing several hundred million of revenue already, the bankers would be clamoring to get at them and take them public. And what a SPAC actually does is it actually allows investors to take probably or arguably a little bit more risk appetite to get access to companies that may be a little bit earlier.
Yeah.
Them significant cash to grow and scale. So I think there's a couple benefits. You obviously get the ability to go public sooner than you might have been able to before as an operator or management team. Oftentimes these come with significant amounts of cash, either coming from the sponsor itself or alongside a pipe or something that happens in the secondary. And then you also get access to the capital markets in the future for, like I mentioned, the pipe or debts or the debt markets. So you're getting liquidity to shareholders. You still have a lockup. It's all dependent on the structure of the SPAC itself. I think the most important thing is the management team has to be ready for what comes with being a public company. And if you're, you know, if you're sub 5 million in revenue or something like that, you know, you probably aren't necessarily ready for a SPAC. If you're in the 20 plus range, you might be ready for a SPAC. But it really depends on the business model. If you've got a completely repeatable business model with recurring revenue and you can go to the street, meet your quarterly or beat your quarterly earnings, it could make sense. If you've got a lumpy business that's dependent on winning individual contracts, large contracts with customers, it may be a much more difficult transition. If you miss a quarter, you're obviously going to get penalized for it in public markets.
Right.
So I think people need to think really hard about whether or not they're ready for being public at this stage and be less concerned about their investors getting excited about liquidity that could potentially come and be less concerned about the economics that the SPAC sponsor gets because those are very lucrative for the sponsor themselves.
Yeah. So I'll stick with the Berkshire Grey example. The cash flow is spot on. They say they're going to have about $507 million in cash when that SPAC closes in the second quarter of this year. They say there will be no debt on the company's balance sheet. But here's, and I understand warehouse automation. Berkshire is claiming only about 5% of warehouses are automated today, which, if you believe them on that, certainly highlights the market opportunity for them, but also for other providers of warehouse automation. I guess I'm just looking at this wrong. I look at them, they were founded in 2013. They said that their revenue in 2020 was $35 million. And to me, that just doesn't, I don't know. Again, I'm not an investment expert, but that just doesn't justify a company to me that I don't know if deserves to be public or warrants being public is the right phrasing. But I guess it doesn't matter what I think. I guess it all that it matters is what the folks who are heading up this SPAC really believe.
Yeah, I mean, that actually becomes pretty philosophical, right? I
Yeah.
mean, you can almost move into the GameStop saga. You can move into lots of things about what is something truly worth or what is the value of something, right? I think the value of something is what people are willing to pay for it and how long they're willing to hold it. If you look at specific SPACs, I think there have been a number that have been head scratchers, right? Our companies at Calibrate are a little bit earlier. We started investing in 2018. So a lot of them haven't necessarily moved in that range. We have some that are close and are getting approached. And we have those hard discussions with our management team, right? I mean, as an investor, we'd obviously like to realize a return.
Sure.
But at the same time, there's a lot of other things that come with being public that you may not be ready for yet. And our goal is to, we don't sell necessarily right when our lockup comes off of the stock. There's lots of stocks we've held for a long time. We can distribute to our investors for them to hold and ultimately realize additional value. So our goal is really to build long, sustainable businesses, not necessarily trade out of something as quickly as we can and realize an exit. Some of those are going to happen, right? People are going to be able to trade
Sure.
out and some amazing exits. But there's going to be a lot that are going to have lockups. And, I think the street and some of these people are going to realize that the shine's come off a little bit and you're going to see a lot of these trade down. I mean, I think there's a really interesting trend happening right now, simply in the D&O insurance market, where D&O insurance has gotten significantly more expensive. And it really comes because the underwriters are seeing what they believe and perceive risk in the public markets. So as they see more IPOs that they may feel are a little bit questionable or have more risk on them, they're increasing the rates for coverage, which is flowing down to even startup market.
So I think I know the answer to this sort of follow-up question, but do you think these SPACs are going to change the investment strategy from a company standpoint, from a an earlier stage company standpoint?
Yeah, I don't think it'll change. I mean, it won't change how we at Calibrate think about our entry point into companies. If they're sustainable and there's continued demand for this type of asset within the public markets, it could think about how we think about follow-on financings, right? I mean, I think there could be ways where you start thinking about, later stage financings are more through SPACs or some sort of other acquisition vehicle. But the earliest stages, the seed, the Series A, the Series B, in most cases are still going to be, I believe, relatively the same.
So one other story that recently happened And then we'll get back to some of the other things that you guys are specifically involved in. But Locus Robotics, a pretty well-known developer of autonomous mobile robots, last week raised a $150 million Series E round. I believe they've now raised about $255 million since they were founded less than 10 years ago. And again, their CEO was on the podcast last week, you know, talking about this, and he said that he believes they should be a publicly traded company. So something to keep an eye on there, but he wouldn't specifically get into revenue. He gave a pretty wide range revenue wise. He said it's somewhere between $10 million and $100 million. Again, pretty wide range when you ask me, but again, we cover investments all the time. I typically don't write about Series E funding. What can you tell me about that? I mean, how popular is Series E funding, and Does a Series E round, does that typically mean anything about how the company is performing?
I think the round for Locus Robotics is great for the industry, right? I think there's generally been beliefs that there hasn't been late stage capital for robotics and automation companies, and this proves that wrong, right? I mean, I think what you've seen a number of Series E's and F's that occur within SaaS companies. And now we're starting to see that with an automation and robotics, which I think is really important for the industry as a whole and the investment community, and something that we've believed is going to happen for a long time. You know, if you go back and you look at our investments that we made at our prior firm in 2010 to 2017, a lot of those companies had raised Series E's and F's. A lot of times those were the last round before a company went public or got acquired as well. I think what that Series E and F really allows you to do is a lot of times it allows a company to really refine its unit economics, build out that customer base, better understand the retention of the customers and what the long-term value of that customer is. I think usually when you're in the BC stage, you're really focused on growth. And then that Series E, F really allows you to take the time to get your books in order, get everything in line, and really start thinking about how this becomes a very long-term sustainable business. And so I think, you know, seeing a Series E in a robotics company, in my mind, is a really good thing.
Oh, that's great to hear. I wasn't necessarily on board with that, but maybe you've won me over with that answer. It makes a lot of sense. And he did say that they were getting ready to refine things and dive even deeper in. But I want to ask you about a couple of different markets that you guys are involved in at Calibrate Ventures, and that's the agricultural robotics market and the construction robotics market. You know, we actually just ran a webinar on the ag market just yesterday. We're doing one on construction robotics in the next couple of months. But you know, I feel like we've been talking about those two markets as being the next big markets for robotics developers and robotics technology for some time. You know, just if you can, tell us what excites you about those markets and specifically about those two portfolio companies for you, FarmWise and Built.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, agriculture space has been something people have been toying around with for a number of years. And like I was saying before, I feel like we're at that tipping point for ag. Construction maybe a little bit further behind, but with an ag, you know, you've talked to FarmWise before. They have an autonomous vehicle that actually goes out and mechanically weeds high value row crops. While they're doing that, they're collecting massive data sets. They're analyzing the images. They're understanding what's happening with soil analysis and water levels. They're creating valuable data that can also then be monetized in other applications beyond the actual weeding they're doing. And so I think, you know, if you look at industries that are ripe for disruption and have the ability to use data in a way that necessarily hasn't done before, I think agriculture is one of those.
So we have a lot of young robotics startups that listen to the podcast. What are some mistakes that you see those young companies often make when, whether it's they're actually pitching investors like yourself, or just in general trying to go out and raise, you know, an early round of funding? What are some of the more common issues that you see take place?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple of things. I think not appreciating how long a sales cycle can be within a certain vertical is something that founders really need to take into account. I think a lot of times robotics companies are asking their customers to implement them into something that is mission critical to their business. And they're not going to do that right off the bat. right? They may give you a line within a warehouse. They may give you a portion of their crops. But for them to actually open up their entire business and go from one initial test product to the entire facility or their entire acreage, it's going to take time. And so I think a lot of, especially earlier, younger startups think that this initial proof of concept they have for a couple hundred K is going to lead to millions of dollars within the next 12 months. And that I've frankly never seen that happen. So I hope it does for some of them, because for them, that'd be amazing. And it would show mass adoption at a rate we haven't seen before. So I think that's the initial one, is really being honest with yourself around what the adoption is going to be for your opportunity. The next one's, it's been happening more and more, and I'd say especially within the last couple of years. Management teams are much more focused on recurring revenue. I think, 10 years ago, even 5 years ago, we saw a lot of companies that didn't have a recurring revenue component. And I think people are much more focused on that, also realize that that's really where they're going to generate the largest outside return for themselves, their opportunity in their business. And then the other one I think is really thinking about how you build a platform as opposed to a specific technology that's helping alleviate one issue. I think you've got to think about how you build a business, right? And I think a lot of times, especially at the seed stage, people are so focused on tech and so focused on the product that they
Right.
don't think about what it takes to build out the project managers, skilled salespeople, really technical marketing, and the organizational culture to start selling things and solving the customer's problem, not just building cool tech. So I think if you have that holistic view at the beginning that you're building a platform that is going out and solving problems for customers, as opposed to building cool tech, I think that's where you're probably seeing better outcomes overall.
I want to steer this back to something you mentioned off the top was, or towards the beginning of our discussion was people, right? You often invest in a company, and the people are an important part of why you chose to invest in that company. I've heard a few stories. These are well told stories of companies that have gone under, right? Rethink Robotics, Cobot Pioneer, founded by Rodney Brooks. Sci-Fi Works, a commercial drone company that was really pioneering tethered commercial drones, founded by the great Helen Graner, who was on the podcast recently. She's also a co-founder of iRobot way back in the day. But she specifically said that she had very different opinions about where the company should go compared to how the investors thought the company should go. And then for the Rethink side of things, everybody, from what I understand, everybody involved in that company knew that the product, the cobot arms, had issues, but the investors had poured so much money into that company that their focus at the time was, instead of going back and raising more money to fix the product, they just had to ship the products that they had, knowing full well that there was some major faults in those products. So my question to you is, how important is it from the robotics company's standpoint to find an investor that they're on the same page with? Is it sounds like that might be easier said than done.
Yeah, I think it's really important, and it's a trade-off, right? I always tell my companies when we're raising follow-on rounds of financing that it's important who you take money from, and that's true. Sometimes you need money, right? But like sometimes you need to take money. And even when we build our own business at Calibrated, it's important to us who our LPs are. So I think if you're an investor in a ro if you're a management team of a robotics company, you're looking for an investor, I would really focus on an investor that understands what you're doing. They may not have to be the most technical person, but they've at least done something within the space. They understand those sales cycles, like I was talking about. And it's not just a firm. You got to focus on the partner, right? You also need to understand the partner dynamics. You need to understand if that partner has the ability to go to his partnership or her partnership and say that there's something here and really push for you, because there are going to be times, especially in robotics, where things take longer than you think. And you need someone that can have the pull within the partnership to be able to support you through that. I think it's also important for anyone taking venture dollars to understand, what that means, right? I mean, venture investors are looking for an outcome with a multiple, and it can change the way business behaves. I always say, rightly or wrongly, that some of the best companies I've ever seen are bootstrap companies, where they haven't raised outside money at all. They've used their own capital to invest. Not all companies can do that, right? You need to spend an R&D and you need to raise money. But oftentimes, I think it's better for companies to raise money more as needed than end up with a large check that changes the dynamics of how they think about their business and how they execute.
I know you got to get going here in a couple of minutes, so I'll let you get out of here on this one. Just what are you looking forward to? You know, what are you keeping an eye on this year? You know, it's been a tricky year. Investments really haven't stopped. Again, $15.7 billion raised for robotics companies back in 2020. Despite the COVID-19 pandemic, hopefully we're coming out of the COVID-19 pandemic in the not too distant future, but just sort of some closing thoughts on your view on where the robotics industry is right now and where it's headed and how investments can play a role.
Yeah, I mean, I think you covered it, right? Like, we're seeing a lot of that.
You're welcome.
People are continuing to invest and grow. I think for us, we're really continuing to focus on the thesis we set out in 2017, focus on digitalization and automation. I think there's some really interesting trends around synthetic data and how those are used with autonomous vehicles, robots, other types of machines to train these systems. Also how to use synthetic data in other parts of your business around digitalization. So that's a big push for us with Calibrate or has been over the last several months and continues to be. And really thinking about how we can continue to unlock value within industries that haven't necessarily taken advantage of that yet.
Kevin Dunlap, co-founder and managing partner of Calibrate Ventures, a venture capital firm investing in early revenue automation and AI companies. Thanks again, man, for joining us on the podcast. Be well and make sure you keep us posted on any new robotics companies that come into your portfolio and certainly the ones that are already there. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve. We'll keep you posted for sure. And if anyone has interest in other opportunities at Calibrate and what we're doing, please take a look at calibratevc.com.
A reminder, folks, that this episode of the Robot Report podcast is brought to you by Futech. Futech Advanced Sensor Technology specializes in the research and development of sensors that measure force, torque, or pressure. For the past 3 decades, Futech has had the privilege to work with leading institutions such as NASA on groundbreaking missions like the 2012 Curiosity Mars rover and the upcoming Viper lunar rover. To find out more about how Futech solutions and capabilities help support innovation in aerospace, visit Futech.com. You can check out applications like a multi-axial torque sensor and instrumentation systems for quadcopter propeller testing or the use of force measurement in the launch mechanisms of unmanned aerial vehicles. You can also explore over 100 application concepts across multiple industries, illustrating the limitless possibilities of Futech's products. Once again, visit Futech.com. Let's turn our attention now to the news and to stay updated on all the latest robotics news. We have you covered with our network of robotics sites. Make sure you check us out at the Robot Report, Robotics Business Review, and Collaborative Robotics Trends. Recapping the news, Motional kicked off the week announcing it's been testing level 4 fully driverless vehicles on public roads in Las Vegas. The testing began earlier in February and consists of multiple Chrysler Pacifica minivans that are autonomously navigating intersections, performing unprotected left turns, interacting with other road users, including pedestrians and cyclists. There is, of course, a caveat. Emotional employee is in the passenger seat during all of these tests and can stop the vehicle if needed. Emotional, they're allowed, according to the state of Nevada. They can test anywhere in Las Vegas, but they're keeping the vehicles in residential areas for now and are only testing during the day. Nevada said they can test whenever they want, but they're being super cautious here. Motional, they're saying there hasn't been any human intervention yet, but here's why the story matters. Motional, the joint venture between Hyundai and Aptiv, joined a short list of robo-taxi companies that have tested fully autonomous vehicles on public roads without safety drivers behind the wheel. Again, I understand they have one in the passenger seat. It's not behind the wheel. There's not too many companies that have done that. Waymo certainly done it. Cruise has certainly done it. Chinese self-driving pioneer AutoX has done that. Baidu has done that. maybe a couple of others that are out there, but that might be it. There's not too many. I know there's other companies. Gatik is one that's hoping to remove the safety driver from their level four autonomous trucks later on this year, but there's not too many on that list. So congrats to Motional for advancing their technology, advancing their systems. Now, they also have a ride hailing program with Lyft that's been up and running in Las Vegas for some time. It's already provided over 100,000 robo taxi rides, paid rides in Las Vegas. This service has always had a human safety driver in it behind the wheel. They're required to be in manual mode when in parking lots and hotel pickup areas, but this fully driverless, where there's no safety driver behind the wheel, is completely separate from that ride-hailing program with Lyft. So a lot going on at Motional. We had Laura Major on an earlier version of the podcast, which we'll link to here in the show notes. But check them out. They're doing some cool stuff if you haven't been keeping up with them. Moving on here, of course, we already discussed the Berkshire Grey SPAC with Kevin Dunlap earlier in the program. But just to quickly recap, Berkshire Grey going public via a SPAC with Revolution Acceleration Acquisition Corp, a blank check firm. The deal values the combined company at $2.7 billion, and the deal is expected to close in the second quarter of the year. Now, the big benefit here to Berkshire Grey, as we mentioned, its operations now have access to about $507 million in cash, and the combined company is expected to have no debt when the deal closes. So, hopefully that's enough for them to scale their technology and capitalize on, these are their numbers, only 5% of warehouses being automated at the moment around the world. So, I've reached out to them. I reached out to them earlier in the week, didn't get a response. So hopefully we get someone over there to come on to the podcast in the coming days, and explain what's going on, explain the thinking behind the SPAC, how it's going to help, just give us their side of the story. But here's a new idea for me. I think I'm going to start a SPAC. Let's take the Robot Report public. Why the heck not? Everybody else is doing it. I'm going to jump on the bandwagon. So if you're interested, reach out and we'll get going here. Moving on, somewhat of a quiet week on the Mars 2020 front, I think. But NASA did start the week with an incredible video that captured the Perseverance rover's final descent and landing on Mars. It's the first ever time there's been video of a NASA rover landing on Mars. Incredible. And they also had they captured the first audio recording of sounds on Mars from one of the microphones on board the rover. So you can watch that video. You can hear that audio on therobotreport.com. We'll make sure we link to it in the show notes. Again, incredible video. Probably the most fascinating thing I've ever seen, because we've literally never seen anything like this before. And we have a story as well. NASA breaks down how the five commercial off-the-shelf cameras on the rover were able to record the video. They go step by step through the rover's final 7 minutes descending onto Mars and what you're seeing from the video. Fascinating stuff. If you haven't seen it, I highly suggest you check it out. Finally, we should note ABB released its next-gen cobots this week. The new Gopha and Swifty six-axis cobots reportedly offer higher payloads and speeds to complement ABB's Yumi cobots. The new cobots, the Gopha and Swifty, really seem to be a little bit more robust, a little bit more suited towards industrial applications than Yumi is. I'm intrigued by the Swifty cobot. ABB said it's literally based off its popular IRB 1100 industrial robot. It sounds like ABB took that model, added several additional safety features to make sure the collaboration around humans is safe at all times. It's got a 4 kilogram payload, but ABB was really touting the speed, the maximum speed of 5 meters per second, which is, I guess, in line with other industrial robots coming now to a collaborative robot, which, of course, the speed of a cobot is one of the downsides of using collaborative robots. So we'll have to see how these new ABB cobots perform, how they gain some market traction here. But if you want to see how the new Gopha and Swifty cobots compare to ABB's Yumi cobots, make sure you check out the article on therobotreport.com. And again, to stay updated on all the latest robotics news, we have you covered with our network of robotics sites. You can check us out at The Robot Report, Robotics Business Review, and Collaborative Robotics Trends. And folks, that's going to do it for episode 36 of the Robot Report podcast. Thanks again to Kevin Dunlap of Calibrate Ventures for joining the program today. And thanks again to all of you for tuning in. New episodes of the podcast drop each week. You can find us on Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, anywhere you get your podcasts. If you haven't already done so, please subscribe, leave us a rating, give us a review. And don't forget to check out our Robo Business Direct series, which continues March 4th when we look at intelligent vision and sensing for robot navigation, object recognition, and control. To register for that session and to check out our full schedule, make sure you visit robobusinessdirect.com. Take care, everyone. We'll talk to you again next week.